I do really find Daniel a wonderful example of a young man really devoting his life to God and keeping on, keeping on. You know, he lived a long life and he held on to the youthful idealism that you see here in Daniel 1 when he was a young man. We see him holding on, really, all his life long. He's really a stellar example, I think. Well, he was amongst the early captives who were first taken into exile by the Babylonians. And it seems, therefore, that he would have been from the royal family or perhaps from the senior levels of the priesthood. But Josephus reckons that he was one of the sons of Zedekiah. Whether that's the case or not is not clear. But certainly he was amongst the elite. And the idea was, according to the records we have of Babylonian policy, the idea was that they wanted to set up local rulers who were local people but who were loyal to Babylon. So the idea was get hold of young upcoming people, and especially young men, and brainwash them basically to the Babylonian way of thinking. And so the example of Daniel is great because he was under a lot of pressure to resign his beliefs and to accept absolutely the teaching of the Babylonians, the culture of the Babylonians, which included, of course, their idols. And the fact he doesn't is all the more, I think, wonderful. So his name was changed to Belteshazzar, literally keeper of the hid treasures of Bel. But he would have been aware that Isaiah had prophesied in Isaiah 46 that Bel, the god of Babylon, was going to be rendered helpless and judged. And so he would have believed that and clung on to that. And it's no good thinking that he was sort of a Sunday school kid who had been well brought up in the faith and who, well, held on to what his mum and dad had taught him when he was suddenly put into a very difficult situation. I don't think so, because the prophetic condemnation of the leading classes of Judah and Jerusalem at the time of the first deportation is absolutely stunning. He would have come from, in fact, a very weak spiritual background. And I think that his strength spiritually was a result of his revulsion against how he had been raised. Maybe that's why his parents aren't mentioned, because it was not thanks to them that he had this faith. He had seen how the prophecies of Jeremiah, which were fairly common knowledge, had come true, and maybe he'd been mentored by Jeremiah literally as a kid. And he'd seen those come true, and he'd seen the mess that comes from following idols. Well, the records that have been preserved of Babylonian policy show that it was typical for young men of about 14 to be put on these three-year programs. So he was probably about 14 when he started this three-year program, which was basically of brainwashing him. And it's to his devotion that at that young age, he stood up for what he believed. As I say, I think he was one of what's called the seed royal. That is, he was from the royal family somewhere. And that means he would not have been well brought up in spiritual things. But he's described in verse 4 as a young man in whom was no blemish, which is the very language, of course, of the sacrifices. So there he was, really giving the best of his life, his mind, his strength to the things of God, when there was huge pressure on him to reject that and take on a totally different worldview. And of course, that is what most of the young people did. I think Daniel's life and attitude to things like drinking wine and drinking the king's food and his general fading from the scene whenever he's promoted in the kingdom, he always sorts of manages to disappear so that years later, well, there's Daniel, there's this guy who can interpret dreams. Now, where is he? When he'd already been made a great senior leader in the kingdom, but then he seems to fade away. I think there's a big contrast between him and Esther and Mordecai, with Mordecai, his name, a form of Marduk, admittedly sometime later when Persia had taken over from Babylon, but very eager for his adopted daughter, Esther, which means star, another form of Marduk, which was a star god. very eager for her to rise up, as it were, and to get into positions of power. And she has clearly no qualms about sleeping with the king before she was married. She has no qualms about preparing the king's wine and making a banquet of wine and so forth for the king and Haman. And I think it contrasts with Daniel, almost intentionally. And so I think that one of the great things about Daniel was not simply his separation from the world, but the way that he stood for principle when all the other young people, apart from perhaps his three friends, of whom he was still the leader, when all the other young people and the Jews had gone into Babylon, had succumbed to the ways of the Babylonians. It's extremely difficult to stand up for principle when your own brethren don't stand for that principle. And he seems to have stood pretty well alone. Because don't forget, they were already worshipping the gods of Babylon even before they went into captivity. That's the bizarre thing, of course, that they turned to the gods of their enemies, and so they were taken into their enemies' land in order to worship their gods. And that is part of the sort of poetic justice in the way they were judged, and the prophets make this point a number of times. But Daniel stood alone. So the dare to be a Daniel idea is, I think, particularly relevant in the sense that he stood up for what he believed, regardless of the fact that his other brethren did not. Especially, as I say, when he was only 14, because this thing in verse 5, he went on this 3-year training scheme, as it were. Well, according to the Babylonian records, they began that with the exiles at age 14, and this was fairly standard practice for young relatives of the rulers or royal family members of the conquered nations. They were brought to Babylon, and at age 14 they were put on this 3-year training scheme, the idea being to train them up to be loyal to Babylon and then to send them back to where they came from to be sort of puppet rulers. So he had a huge amount of pressure on him. And when you look at it, the names of Daniel and his three friends, they've all got the name of God in them. And the meanings of the names all hint at an awareness of the prophets and the prophet's message. Now, Daniel means God is judge. Maybe the idea is that God was the ultimate judge who had merely used Babylon to judge Judah, and Babylon was going to be judged as well. Hananiah, whom Yah has favored. And this alludes to the restoration prophets, that God would favor Judah and bring them out of exile. Mishael, who is like God. Similar idea in Isaiah 40, verse 18, who is like the God who restores Judah. Azariah, help of Yah. God said, using the same words, that he would help Judah in restoring them from Babylon. And I wondered if these young men actually named themselves this way. This was their self-identification. And I love verse 8. But Daniel determined not to defile himself. He determined. And as I say, that determination was the stronger because it was taken when his fellow brethren, for the most part, did not have that determination. So it's easy to split life up into black and white, sin and not sin. And people often ask me, oh, is this a sin? Can I do this? Or would that be a sin? And a lot of these issues are not a case of sin or not sin. It's a case of degrees of response to God's grace and degrees of commitment to him. I mean, I'm not saying there is not sin and not sin, but I'm saying that the line that divides is not always in those terms. There is likewise, as I say, a degree of response. I mean, was it wrong to drink this wine? Well, you could argue that, well, God would not damn you if you did. They were in a difficult situation, etc. But whatever, he determined he would not defile himself. Well, that was his conscience, because it would be hard to argue from the law of Moses, which was all that they had sort of extant to go on, that actually drinking certain kinds of wine or whatever was going to defile you. The meat may or may not have been unclean. That could have defiled. But his idea is, this is associated with idol worship. I am not going to partake of it. And you see how the steward says to him in verse 10, do you really want me to endanger my head with the king? And that gives a window into the sort of despotic sort of way of Nebuchadnezzar. He just beheaded his servants for the slightest perceived lack of obedience. And this idea of his, that the food of his table, which was effectively seen as the table of the gods, because he was deified as the god, it was his idea, I think, that the food from his table, with all its religious connotations, should be fed to these young Jews. And so to purposefully sort of go around the king's personal policy was a pretty big risk. Well, the steward did agree, and at the end of 10 days, verse 15, their faces appeared fairer and fatter. I don't think that it's accidental that fair and fat is the very same Hebrew phrase used about the seven fat ears of corn in Pharaoh's dream in Genesis 41. There's so many echoes of the Joseph story. It's as if Daniel eventually found himself with Joseph as his template. You remember how he's rushed in, where's the Hebrew who can explain the dreams? He's rushed into the king's presence at least twice, just as Joseph was, to explain Pharaoh's dreams. And remember, Joseph was called Zaphnath-Paaneah. Well, it can mean saviour of the world, but I think the Egyptian idea was more like that it meant interpreter of dreams. And that would have been more appropriate, really, as a title for Joseph. And so he would have seen that Joseph was his kind of precedent. And so man is not alone. When you think that you're faced with a bewildering array of choices, and particularly young folks, teenagers are at that point, there is guidance. You can see the spirit, I think, of how you should go by looking at people in the Bible. And I think that Daniel looked at Joseph, and there was there a kind of a template for him. Well, 17, as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So they were particularly trained in interpreting dreams, and this was all connected with idolatry. It was really training in mythology. And yet Daniel was given success in this, so he was in a very difficult situation. Well, we're told in verse 18 that at the end of the days which the king had appointed for bringing them in, the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Well, that means that as prince of the eunuchs, the people underneath him would have been eunuchs. And one assumes, therefore, that Daniel was castrated. So there they were, these teenagers who'd been castrated. And of course, that would rather fit in with the prophecy that was given to Hezekiah. The days come, he was told, that all that you've got will be carried to Babylon, and your sons, in the sense of your descendants, who shall issue from you, they will take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. That's in 2 Kings 20. So it seems then that Daniel had to accept he would never probably get married and certainly not have children. So he had a pretty bleak life to look forward to. But instead, he put his energy into devotion to his God and separation from the evil empire that was seeking to psychologically dominate him. So his zeal for the things of God is sort of psychologically understandable. And really, though, I think this should be the case, really, for all our young people, and not just young people, for all of us, that you sense in Daniel a man with a mission, and we all have a mission. We are under incredible psychological pressure. We are surrounded spiritually by an evil empire. No matter what nation you live in, the flesh, sin is all around you, and it is an evil empire. And it is trying to brainwash you. And he was aware of that. And he devoted himself to the things of God and resisted it. When he was surrounded by other people who were supposedly the children of God, the people of God, who gave in and settled into the soft life and all the idolatry and pagan ideas that were all around them. So, he was brought in before Nebuchadnezzar in verse 18. But Daniel 2 verse 1 says that Daniel interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that's of the image, in his second year. So I wondered if chapter 2 is explaining how this reputation for wisdom and interpretation of dreams was kind of built up. The Bible often does that, and it's quite common in Hebrew and Semitic writing that a conclusion is stated and then there is a sort of an excursus to explain how that position was arrived at. It means that what you're reading as text doesn't necessarily flow chronologically, which is very different to the sort of stress on chronology that you find typically in Greek and generally European writing. But that's not how it is in Hebrew thought. And so I think that if his appearance before Nebuchadnezzar was in his second year, he may have only been, in that case, 15 or at the most 16 when he interpreted that dream. Don't tell me that God can't work with young people. He really can. And, you know, young men are the best soldiers, young women are the best soldiers. Young folks are the best in that sense to get a job done. And there is a particular appeal of the gospel to youth. As I say, it is to all ages, but it is particularly to youth who are looking for a cause to fight for. They're looking for a revolution to make. They're looking to be different. They're looking to fight an evil empire. And all those desires of youth are met, absolutely, in the call of the gospel to a radical life, to radical self-sacrifice, to risk, to risking life, as Daniel certainly risked his life in the way that he did. And so, as I say, he was taking the cue from Pharaoh in verse 19. They served the king. Literally, they stood before the face of the king. That's the very same term that's used of Joseph being brought before Pharaoh and standing before the king, Genesis 41, 46. So all the time, he'd have seen that his hunch that that Joseph was his template was sort of being developed. And when years later he's called for, suddenly, unexpectedly, as it were, quickly come in and read the writing on the wall and things like that. Oh, yeah, he'd have thought, okay, yeah, the Joseph template continues, and so it does. So really, this is a fine example of having a cause to fight for. There he was, probably castrated, pretty bleak life in front of him. There he was, consciously in a program of brainwashing to remove from him his belief in the God of Israel and God's principles. His family background would have been basically idolatry and a very low-key commitment to Yahweh, just on a cultural level, cultural Christianity, as it were. And he rebels against all that and totally determines that he's going to resist the evil empire, that he is going to rise up above this. Now, this is a great pattern for any teenager. Of course you want to kick everything over. Of course you don't want to go the way around you. Of course you want to rebel against how you were brought up. Of course you want to be a rebel. Of course you do. That's quite natural, and God knows that. Of course you want to be different. Of course you want to overthrow the system. Of course you want to resist. Of course you want to fight for freedom, no matter how apparently vain it seems. Of course you want to. And there in the things of the gospel, you have the opportunity to do that for the ultimately good cause, so that you're not going to, you know, fight for some human, political or military cause, and then at the end of it, well, you're going to end up in your 30s, 40s, 50s, if you get that far, disillusioned. So many people are like that, vast majority. they regret the naivety of their youth, where they gave their best years and their best strength to something that they then see as God feet of clay, to something that they then see was not the ideal. And yet, the great thing with Daniel is that he carried it on right to the end of his days, and he lived a long life. Just as I have done, I haven't lived a long life, but, you know, just as so many have done, who saw the truth of Jesus Christ in their youth, and who gave their lives to it, not perfectly, but in their hearts they did. This was the cause that will not disillusion. This is the captain and the leader who will not turn out to have feet of clay. This is the kingdom to fight for. This is the party to go for. And there will not be any disillusion, but in fact a growing appreciation and gratitude that we chose to fight for the right side.